Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen, and joining me in the studio right now is Dr. Latika Gupta. She is the Assistant Professor of Economics at Michigan Tech. Latika, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Rick. It's great to be back here.
And we'll be talking because, you know, you recently did a lecture that was, you know, people in the public were welcome to come to, and I thought it was a very interesting topic, and I thought I'd steal you and have you come talk about that same topic here on Copper Country Today. The title of your lecture was Borrowing, Bernanke, and Beyond, the Whys, Whodunits, and What's Next, referring to the financial crisis, oftentimes called the Great Recession, that we experienced about 10 years ago. And, you know, I'm interested to find out what sort of led up to that financial crisis, what were the causes, and what was the impact on people. I personally was impacted. I can talk about that as well. And then also what we learned, you know, trying to come out of that so that, you know, we can hopefully minimize, you know, that kind of a effect later on. Maybe avoid it, which probably is going to be impossible to do. But maybe we can at least adopt a few different strategies, if not as a nation personally, so that you don't get as affected by it. So let's go ahead and start with a little bit travel back in time. Take me to just prior to 2008 and what the markets in the country were like and worldwide, because I know things were booming at the time.
I'm glad you enjoyed the lecture, Rick. The seeds for the Great Recession were really sown in the early 2000s when the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates multiple times during the early 2000s. And that low interest rate made credit really cheap and easily available. In addition to that, the investment banks, combined with government agencies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, created these new financial instruments called mortgage-based securities. And these made investments into securities like mortgage-based securities really attractive for investors that were not really aware of how risky these investments were. But at the same time, homeowners were able to get credit very easily and cheaply. So on one hand, you had people who were able to get credit at a very cheap rate. Let's say somebody who was sitting in China, who was able to lend their money, who was able to put money in a pension fund, who were not aware of how risky their investment was. And they were putting all of their money into a pension fund. And on the other hand, you had somebody, let's say, sitting in Houghton and putting money into a bank account. Somebody who was putting, getting a mortgage from a mortgage broker. And there were several entities in between, for example, a mortgage broker and several financial institutions, whether it was an investment bank or whether it was a pension fund. And so you have all these entities connecting those, that ultimate buyer and ultimate lender. And there was really no incentive for either the buyer or the lender to think about the risk involved. And the securities that were involved in these were so risky, they were so complicated, that even the financial institutions didn't really know what they were doing. Mm.
So this is often referred to as the housing bubble, because I remember that term being thrown around there after everything kind of fell apart. And interesting is in that particular time frame is that's when I had became a homeowner for the first time. And so when, you know, they were talking about predatory lenders and other terms that were now being tossed around, and people said, well, it's not in a bank's best interest to lend money to somebody who can't pay it back, and so that would be silly for them to do that. No, actually, we were in a position, speaking of my wife and I, where we hadn't built, really much credit of anything. We had never been homeowners before. Mm-hmm. Housing, we were living in an area where housing was very expensive. The house that we ended up buying was $150,000. There was paperwork that when presented to us, it was presented in a way of, you know, sign here, just don't look at this. And we were actually told, the lenders said, don't look at this paper because it'll just give you nightmares. Uh-huh. Well, what the paper does is explain that we were, you know, on the hook for $400,000 paying back after uh-huh. interest rates and stuff. And it wasn't just some, you know, crazy, you know, financing company we never heard of. We were financed through Wells Fargo. Uh-huh. And then, of course, you know, looking at and not realizing what we were getting into mm-hmm. at the time, and we take the responsibility for that, was this 80-20 package where there was this giant balloon payment mm-hmm. that was going to be due relatively soon that we were, again, we were told, don't worry about that because all you got to do is make your payments for the first year, then refinance that part, and you won't have to worry about paying that. Well, none of that ever actually happened. And we ended up in a whole lot of trouble financially. And we were one of those, you know, millions of people who ended up losing, you know, a home that we had no business probably buying in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I actually, one of the terms that I used during the lecture was layered irresponsibility. And I did not come up with that term. It was actually a term that I saw in the Economist magazine, which actually is one of my favorite terms that I've come across during the Great Recession. It is a combination, I think, you know, it's a combination of blame that you can put on a lot of different entities. And, you know, yeah, mortgage brokers are one of them. They didn't really care about who they were giving loans to. All they cared about was commission. And the term that I have come across is ninja loans, which is no income, no job, no asset loans. So they were giving out loans to people who, and not necessarily yourself because you do have a job, but you know, and you probably do have assets as well.
Well, at the time, I showed no proof that I would be able to pay that loan back. Mm-hmm. Of course, I was excited. We were about to become homeowners. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we were very starry-eyed going into mm-hmm. the thing, going, wow, you know, after being renters for mm-hmm. so long that somebody, you know, this is the true story. I was sitting in a bar, mm-hmm. actually working in a bar, and somebody was sitting at the bar saying that, he's having trouble finding, you know, enough people to buy the homes he's got available. Mm-hmm. And I was there and said, well, I'd buy a home if I could get the financing. He goes, well, I can get you the financing. You just got to pick out the house.
Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, they didn't really worry about verifying any of those details. No income, no job, no asset loans, the ninja loans. Those ninja loans were given out very easily. And mortgage brokers didn't really care about who they were giving the loans to because they were just simply passing on the risk to the financial institutions, to the investment banks, who were then passing on the risk to a different financial institution, and then they were just selling those off to other types of institutions and bundling those off into something a little bit more risky.
Yeah. Now, that's the part where I think people start to lose their understanding of it. The average person is when it starts getting into the markets and, mm-hmm. and then you have, you know, you mentioned Bernanke in your title here mm-hmm. and then, you know, everybody knows about the Madoff scandal, mm-hmm. you know, Bernie, and what was going on sort of on the large global mm-hmm. scale that would cause, mm-hmm. you know, it all to come crashing down. So mm-hmm. what was the tipping point that started the downturn?
Well, you know, we reached a point where there was ultimately, you know, ultimately too much supply and too little demand for houses. You know, people started failing on their payments. You know, you have all these people who bought these houses and were unable to make their payments, and some people really shouldn't have bought those houses in the first place, or those houses were too big for them, they were too expensive for them, and they really shouldn't have bought those houses in the first place. They were unable to make those payments, and when people were unable to make those payments, investment banks were not receiving the money, and some of those houses started going up on the market. They started getting foreclosed, and pretty soon we started seeing foreclosure rates go up. And as foreclosure rates started going up, we started seeing more and more houses getting put up for sale. So banks started seizing up those markets, those houses, and we start seeing foreclosure rates go up. And we just towards the end of 2007, we start seeing the foreclosure rates go up as new, more and more houses are getting seized. And in 2007, 2008, that just ends up bursting that bubble. And you start seeing financial institutions like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, failing. Also government-based agencies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were created for promotion of home ownership, started failing as well. AIG, which is an insurance company, which was essentially created which essentially failed primarily because they were insuring credit default swaps. That was one of the reasons why AIG failed, and there were a large number of commercial bank failures as well.
How close did we get to a huge global economic disaster? We had a recession, but how close did we get to, you know, seeing something that was in a magnitude we could never imagine?
We saw a lot of other countries fail as well. A number of other countries also started experiencing economic crisis. We live in a globalized world. A number of other countries had also purchased experienced similar crises. They also had experienced similar bubbles. In Europe, especially, we actually experienced more of a debt crisis. Countries like Greece and Cyprus actually had a government debt crisis, so that was a little bit more different. In that particular case, Greece was actually cooking up their books. So that's a pretty interesting story. So they were actually cooking up their books, but in that particular case, they actually had to bail out the Greek government because otherwise the entire euro would have crashed. Iceland was one of the few countries that actually went through a depression. In Europe, we had pigs spelled with a triple I. So that's sort of a derogatory term that's used for Portugal, Iceland, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. So those were the countries that were going through a major economic crisis. But, even in countries like the United Kingdom, there had to be austerity measures because those countries were going through a pretty bad crisis as well.
I know it was hitting home here as well. Had relatives who had built a 401k through work, and of course that's an investment type of retirement plan. Mm-hmm. And my aunt had said that she had to stop looking, mm-hmm. At the investments after about $50,000 had gone, from their investments. She said she had to just stop looking and walk away from it. Mm-hmm. Now, in time, because they actually are still working towards retirement, of course, things have rebounded. But, it was a time of great concern for, even a lot of just regular working people who did not buy, mm-hmm. Who had bought a house and were making their payments and were working and everything was going fine. It was affecting everybody, people getting laid off from jobs that they had counted on, losing their retirement altogether. Certainly, if you worked in certain industries, you were hit harder than others. And as these conditions began to pile up, what actions did our government take and the market take in order to try to right the ship?
Well, so, let me address the first part of your comment there. So you're right, it was really hard for regular people in a lot of different ways because on the one hand, you're losing your home. On the other hand, you're seeing your savings, your wealth completely wiped out. And that can't be easy. And then at the same time, getting loans is hard because there was a complete tightening of the credit market. So getting loans wasn't easy. So even though the Federal Reserve was injecting money into the economy, banks were so scared to lend out money. There was a complete credit crunch. So there was a complete tightening of the market. Banks were completely scared of lending money. And so, Anna Schwartz, who's an economist, said that it's not really a liquidity crisis. It's more of a crisis of trust. at this point. So the Great Recession, in a lot of ways, could be termed as a crisis of trust rather than a liquidity crisis, because the Federal Reserve did inject a lot of money. And I think in a lot of ways, that's something that we still haven't repaired. And that's something that we still didn't address. So that still answers your second question to some degree, that, you know, there are things that that the Federal Reserve did do. One of the things that they did was lower the interest rate, and which they do by injecting money into the economy. So that's by increasing the money supply. So they lowered the federal funds rate, and that they lowered that to almost near 0%, to about a quarter of a percentage. And so that was one of the things that they did. The other thing that they did was they actually lent money to more than just banks. So typically, traditionally, the Federal Reserve would only lend out money to commercial banks, but they opened up their window. It's actually known as a discount window, but they actually opened up their bank window to more than just commercial banks. So they actually started lending out to more than just the traditional financial institutions. And started, you know, we also started seeing tax rebates, and both during the Bush administration and the Obama administration, we saw $168 billion stimulus, and then the $787 stimulus. We saw the increase of the FDIC coverage, so which is when you open a bank account, your bank will tell you that in case the bank fails, in case there is a bank run or a bank failure, the Federal Deposit Insurance Company would come and bail out the bank. So the FDIC basically increased that coverage as well. We also had the TARP funds for the Troubled Asset Relief program for banks as well. So those are some of the programs that, those are some of the policy responses that we had.
So that's really is an example of where government policies did come in, mm-hmm. and, you know, virtually save the economic system.
Yes. So those were some government policies that happened. In addition to that, we actually had some regulations that were put in place, and we could talk a little bit about that if you like. So some of those regulations were putting restrictions on shadow banks. So one thing that is important to understand is that the crisis that we had was actually related to banks that are of the nature of not traditional commercial banks. So they were financial institutions that don't perform the job of your regular commercial banking institutions. So those are called shadow banks. And so we have a lot of restrictions and regulations on commercial banks, but we don't have a lot of restrictions and regulations on commercial banks. And so the idea was to put some restrictions and regulations on shadow banks. So for example, restricting their size. You might have heard the term too big to fail.
Yep.
So, you know, if the point is that if they're too big to fail, maybe they're too big after all, right? So, and if they are too big, then maybe they should be holding more capital. Maybe they should have more capital, or maybe they shouldn't be too big after all. And you know, reducing the amount of risk that they are taking, and just making sure that the regulations, there's more coordination amongst different regulatory bodies. We have a lot of regulatory bodies in the United States, but there's just lack of coordination among them. And that's essentially what was known as the Dodd-Frank Act. So all of this that I just mentioned, all of these regulations.
So when did things start to turn around? When did we start seeing, you know, some return on the investment, so to speak, on some of these policy changes?
You know, the unemployment rate stayed at 10% for a very long time. And, you know, the recession technically ended in 2009, but the unemployment rate did not reach its peak even until a few years later. And it took a long time before the unemployment rate even continued even started falling. And part of the reason is that there was a lot of uncertainty in the economy even after the recession ended. So firms started recovering from the recession. They started producing more output, but they preferred hiring machines rather than hiring workers in order to produce more output. So they were more reluctant to hire workers because it's easier to get rid of a machine rather than it is to get rid of a worker. So that was one of the reasons why it was so hard for people to find jobs. And because there was just so much uncertainty in the economy. And for businesses to invest in the economy was also very hard because, like I mentioned earlier, it was really hard for people, for small businesses, for whether it's large businesses or small businesses, to get loans because banks were just really scared.
Now, I would think that we learned a lot from going through this and would hopefully not make the same mistakes. But, you know, like right now we're seeing, you know, markets just booming other than, you know, recently with some market correction. But, you know, we're seeing same kind of, you know, accelerated growth that makes people wonder, wait a minute, okay, how, you know, what's going on? How could this be growing this fast, this soon? And are worried for that other shoe to drop, you know, and we don't want a repeat of 2008. Where are we right now is, you know, with, you know, all the regulations and stuff that were put in 10 years ago and shortly after that, are they working? And that's why we're seeing so, you know, so much improvement, or are we ignoring them, or has markets changed to where they're not really relevant anymore?
It is a little bit hard to tell, but there are concerns that all that money that was injected into the economy, there is going to be a little bit of backlash from that because the Federal Reserve did inject a lot of money into the economy and kept the interest rate really low. And so that might have some backlash on the economy. You know, it's been 10 years that the interest rate was so low. And so one of the side effects of that might be high inflation rate in the future. And that was one of the concerns that brought down the stock market a little bit in the last couple of weeks. That's one of the side effects that's expected. Another one that is expected is that right now the Federal Reserve has a really bloated balance sheet. They bought a lot of assets, a lot of financial assets, and they might have to eventually get rid of those. And they have all these assets that they don't typically hold. And there are concerns there are other bubbles that might burst in the future. One of them, of course, is the student debt crisis. There are nearly 40% of student debt holders who have already defaulted on loans. That's one area where we expect a crisis. Another area where we expect a crisis is the auto loan market. We actually have a similar situation going on in the auto loan market. There's a subprime auto loan market similar to the subprime mortgage crisis. There's a similar crisis expected in the auto loan market.
Yeah, didn't they go through something like that in the mid-90s or something? You know, I remember when auto loans all of a sudden became difficult to get back when they were, for a while there, they were real, real easy.
Yeah, it is. You know, right now we are seeing a big supply in cars, but not a lot of demand for it.
Yeah, not a lot of demand for vehicles that cost $40,000. I mean, they're going to, you know, I've been looking at that as something that's going to have to hit us eventually, because once you start pricing out the average American worker who can no longer afford a new vehicle, or where their vehicle is going to be more than their mortgage payment, that can't be sustainable.
And you're also looking at a generational change here. You're looking at a generation that doesn't want to buy cars that frequently. They don't want to change cars that frequently, especially in urban areas where people just prefer taking Uber everywhere. Or, you know, you're also looking at cars that last 300,000 miles or 400,000 miles. People are just not going to want to buy cars that frequently. Just to give you an example, in 2016, U.S. car makers gave more in discounts than they pay to their workers. That's something to think about.
Oh. So here's a question, because we, you know, during this whole interview, and we really haven't addressed any kind of politics or the, you know, political climate with and how it affects things. Just have, you know, anybody that's lived through this, you know, they, you know, from, you know, George W. Bush being blamed for the entire economic meltdown, for President Obama being, you know, blamed at the beginning and then, you know, praised as the one who saved everything, to Trump being taking a lot of credit himself for the market bounding back. But then also, you know, people are ready to blame him in case it all boils down. So how much effect does, you know, those politics, and especially in those higher level offices, really have an effect on the, you know, all of these things that we talked about, and the, you know, the market fluctuations, the growth, and the bursting of bubbles? Do, you know, are we correctly assigning blame and credit when we do that?
You know, ultimately, the blame lies in everybody. Everybody has to take blame a little bit. You know, if you look at who's to take blame for the crisis? It's the Federal Reserve for keeping interest rates low for too long. Home buyers for buying houses that they shouldn't have bought. Mortgage brokers for giving out loans recklessly, just caring about their commission. Investment banks for creating these complicated securities. Rating agencies giving high ratings to these securities that they didn't understand. Regulators for not regulating the markets, for not regulating these investment banks. And then, yes, government policymakers. You know, you can think about a lot of different ways in which government policymakers can be blamed. Whether it's the creation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that was essentially done to promote home ownership and to actually promote securitization of mortgage-based securities, to give down payments to people who couldn't afford houses, which we can argue in some ways that, you know, if they can't really afford houses, then maybe they shouldn't be buying those houses, right? And then for ending the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act was ended in 1999, which separated the commercialization and the investment banking function of houses. For example, you mentioned that you got your loan from Wells Fargo. And, you know, Wells Fargo in the past would have to separate their commercial banking function from investment banking function. But now those functions can be performed together. Mm.
So going forward, you know, this, if you're, say, like your average person, like myself, I consider myself an average person, and then, you know, I'm actually entering into the market right now with some investments, and, you know, it's a first opportunity that I've had to be able to plan a future and start, you know, worrying, you know, concerning myself about retirement in 20 years, and so I'm starting in these, you know, to put my money on the line, you know, as much as anybody else is now. What are some things that somebody like me can, you know, should be wary of, and can I do anything to protect myself?
Well, one thing that I would recommend is always keep yourself educated and keep yourself informed of what's going on in the economy. And, you know, one thing that we were discussing before the program started is always be mindful that the next recession is just around the corner and be prepared. And always save money and diversify.
All right. Dr. Latika Gupta, it's been a pleasure. I learned a lot. And we're going to, of course, put this up on KeymanoReport.com if you want to be able to review this and let us know what you think as well. So thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thank you.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.